Hi there, and welcome to Open Mic here on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're visiting with author Thomas Stevens to talk about his new book, Civil War Game Changers. Tom, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Leanne.
Now, you're kind of an expert when it comes to Kentucky history. Let's talk a little bit about some of your previous works before we get into your newest,
sure.
newest work. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that we've seen before. I know you've been here in the studios before to talk about some of your stuff. One of your previous works that came out that interests me, of course, you did something completely different about the UK sports tradition.
Right. It was kind of an interesting book to put together. It was called First Cats, and it was the origins of the University of Kentucky sports. Everything from cheerleading to basketball to football, all the way back to 1871, and it was a lot of fun to put together. It took me about 3 years to do the research and about another year to write, and it was very successful. I think we sold out in 8 weeks. And it was a blast. You know, I did the Joe B. and Denny show a couple times and did a lot of television. And it was a lot of fun to put together. I met a lot of descendants of some of these people. I really enjoyed it. I found that the University of Kentucky didn't keep track of the names of their players very well in the early days. And so I was able to meet a lot of these people or their descendants. I had a poster with the first women's basketball team in the restart in the 1980s. And a woman came up to me before a UK basketball game and said, "That's me." And so that was a lot of fun because they didn't get a chance to, you know, to have any glory. You know, they were trailblazers at the time. And it was not as big as it got today. I mean, they're number 10 in the country today, the women, and you know.
But with the popularity of UK basketball, it's funny. People from other states will talk to me about like the rabidness of UK fans, and I'm like, listen, we don't have professional sports teams here.
Right.
UK is kind of what a lot of people treat like professional,
sure.
And be that basketball or football, women's basketball,
whatever. And it's the topic of conversation always.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the thing that
I'm sure it is this morning after a loss.
For sure. Definitely this morning after a loss. Now, but really history is kind of the more historic stuff, not the sports stuff. True bluegrass stories, I definitely wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. What got you interested in going into the history of Kentucky and finding those individual stories?
Well, I'm a sucker for a good story. I love that, and it just sort of supercharges it for me when there is a story out there that really isn't commonly known. So if I can sort of lift the veil on Kentucky's past for people, I really enjoy that, and putting together, you know, the story in an interesting way. And there's a lot of things that happen here that people don't know about, and people should.
Right. Now, with the newest work, it's called Civil War Game Changers, Kentucky and Kentuckians in America's Bloodiest Conflict. What inspired you to write this particular novel? That's a long title.
It is.
But there's
and I'm a sucker for long titles. I was working on the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. Doing some research on Lincoln and the Civil War. And I was just floored one day when I realized it was almost like Kentuckians were strategically placed to help Abraham Lincoln win that war. And that's not the case, of course. It was random. But Kentuckians were sort of pivot points in history. They made the right decision at exactly the right time to affect the outcome and really make the world or make the country that it is today.
Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, we see that, but at the time, it was just kind of a
oh, right. Everything was hanging in the balance at all times. And for example, you have John Buford, who, ironically, his grandfather had served with Robert E. Lee's father in the Revolutionary War. And he was asked by the governor of Kentucky, Beriah McGoffin, to come to Kentucky and, quote, "you can have what you want." And he replied, "What I want to be is a captain in the U.S. Army, and that's what I'll continue to be." And this is right at the beginning of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so fast forward 2 years, and Buford finds himself at a very small college town And he happens to notice during the time when Lee is invading north, going to Pennsylvania, carrying the war to the north, and Buford opens up a map, and he sees this little town happens to be the intersection of 10 streets, major roads through the state going, you know, all points pretty much on the compass. And that was a very unusual thing, of course. And he realized that if you controlled this little town, you could control, you know, pretty much half the state. And if Lee was coming north, he was going to have to deal with whoever had that town. And that little town was named Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. And so he put men on the ridges, and he held it. Lee was considered invincible. The Army of Northern Virginia was considered invincible by both sides because the officers of those armies had served or been taught under Lee at West Point. And so the Union guys were scared to death of him. And one of his advantages was to gain the high ground. He had a knack for doing that, and Buford denied him that. And it was instrumental in winning that battle, which is the bloodiest battle in American history. Mm-hmm. And really, even though it happened 2 years before the end of the war, it really did decide the war and right. the outcome.
Everything changed at that point.
But that man from Woodford County, Kentucky, who grew up in Scott County, determined that outcome.
I think that as a native Kentuckian myself, I didn't really realize that Kentucky, because everything, you know, everything happened east of here, everything happened south of here, north of here, of course. But I didn't think Kentucky played that big of a role in the Civil War. But you said, at the, you know, right on the front of the book, Abraham Lincoln himself felt that Kentucky was vital.
Right. And he was talking to a Kentuckian. He was writing to Orville Browning, who was also from Scott County. He was a senator from Illinois. And he was really Lincoln's principal advisor. They were trying to figure out what to do. And Lincoln said, "I think to lose Kentucky is the same as to lose the whole game. Kentucky lost. We can't hold Maryland or Missouri, and we might as well just give up, including give up Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the situation. You had to have Kentucky. And that goes into the title as well, Game Changers. Mm-hmm. Lincoln said to lose Kentucky is to lose the game, and Kentuckians were the game changers in the war. Now, historians will tell you, or, you know, often portray the war as taking place between Richmond, Virginia, and Washington, D.C., and that has sort of been glorified over the century and a half, and it's not really true. The people who won the war were operating in the West, what was called the West at the time, in Kentucky, Tennessee. Ulysses S. Grant, who is a virtual Kentuckian, spent a lot of his time here. His father's business was here. His children and his wife were here throughout the war. His father's house in Covington was a military installation much of the time. And so he and William Tecumseh Sherman, who made his name for himself in Louisville, they are the ones that Lincoln chose to finish the war and win it in 1865. And they were operating in Kentucky in 1861 and 62.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about those people, that these characters, these historic characters in your book. But first, I want to talk about the research that went into it. It's not like you went to the library one afternoon and wrote this book. How long did you spend on this one?
Well, off and on, probably 3 or 4 years. I had some kernels of stories. I was a history columnist at Kentucky Monthly Magazine in Frankfort, and I did a sesquicentennial history of the war, just in columns. And you don't have much space in a magazine article, that's about true. 1,500 words. Mm-hmm. And so some of these stories were so good that I felt really cramped in those parameters. And so I wanted to flesh out the stories, get more of the information in. And so many of them became chapters in the book. But I also researched probably 6 or 7 more because I just knew the stories. The research is, in former days, I spent a lot of time in libraries and special collections and places like that. But I find that today, you're sort of, as a researcher, you can accelerate, or at least you can find things that were unfindable in the past. Mm-hmm. For example, the Library of the Library of Congress has a newspaper archive, and you can find little bits of information that is lost in Kentucky because we don't have microfilm copies of these newspapers. But that little item was picked up in Chicago or Connecticut, and you can find what is lost in Kentucky. You can re-find it, and those things made their way into the book. And I really enjoy that process.
Now, researching now, as even opposed to 10 years ago, is so different. I mean, mm-hmm. did you have to travel a lot, or is a lot of your research done digitally?
No, I did. The research that I did was at the Filson Club in Frankfort, several other libraries in Kentucky, special collections. But a lot of the rest of it was online stuff mm-hmm. that you can find through the Library of Congress. Many of the photos come from there. Pristine 8.5 by 11 glass plate negatives that are just perfect, you know, that reproduce very well. Mm-hmm. I used those when I could.
Wow. And that's something that, you know, 10 years ago you would have had to made a, you know, a week trip to go up there and see, whereas now you can just press a button.
And anybody can do it, www.loc.gov, mm-hmm. and you can look all through there and find lots of things about just about anything you're interested in, including Kentucky. Lots of photographs, lots of things.
I think that that's kind of becoming a more popular pastime, and one of the reasons that your book will be most popular. And we're going to talk a little bit about more of those historic characters, but first we need to take a quick break here on Open Mic. We'll be right back after this.
Celebrate Valentine's Day with Le Cabaret at the Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling, 7:30 p.m. on Friday, February 14th. An evening of love, life, desserts, music, and fun. Tickets are $15 online or at the door. Enjoy Valentine's Day with Le Cabaret at the Gateway Regional Arts Center, 7:30 p.m. on Friday, February 14th. Tickets online at grackentucky.org.
And we're back here on Open Mic here at Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're talking with Tom Stevens, talking about his new book, Civil War Game Changers, Kentucky and Kentuckians in America's Bloodiest Conflict. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you, Leanne.
Now, I wanted to talk about some of these very interesting characters, and the one, when I'm looking at this information flyer that you gave me before you came on the show, this picture of this individual in the middle of the page, Dr. Mary Walker. And
yes.
I looked at the picture before I looked at the name underneath and thought, what a dapper young man. But this is a woman.
That's right.
And that's surprising for that time. I mean, yes. Now people dress androgynously and it's perfectly acceptable and you see it all the time.
Right.
But in the time of the Civil War, Dr. Mary Walker was very surprising.
Yes, yes. She was into practicality, and she was a doctor, a surgeon from Syracuse, New York. And when the war began, she went down to the first battle, which was called Bull Run. She offered her services at a hospital there, and she gave them her credentials as a doctor and a surgeon, and they told her she could be a nurse. And so she proved herself over time, and after a while they were letting her do surgery. And she's in this hospital, and you know, this is Victorian times, 1860s, and she's wearing a hoop skirt. She said, I cannot do this job this way. And so she started trying to modify her clothing to the point that it became, if you were wearing leggings with a little skirt, that's pretty much the equivalent of what she came up with. Mm-hmm. And that's the way she operated on people in emergency situations on the battlefields of the Civil War. And the Union Army allowed that. She was a civilian employee, what was called a contract surgeon. And they allowed her to do that because her services were so vital. I mean, people were going to live or die, depending on whether a surgeon could do what needed to be done at the time. And so in the course of the war, she spent much of the war in hospital tents. She was captured by the Confederates and spent almost a year in prison in a Confederate military prison. Not the best of conditions, by the way. She was finally released. Her next job was Louisville, and she was placed in charge of the women's prison in Louisville. And it's really kind of hard to understand. Americans believe in freedom of speech and all that, but Kentuckians in particular had difficulty because Kentucky was a non-seceding state. Kentucky hadn't done anything wrong, and yet it was under military law, under martial law. And if you spoke against Abraham Lincoln, for example, or the Union effort, you would be put in prison without trial. And so lots of ladies of Louisville found themselves in that situation. And when she got there, they were in cells with or next to prostitutes, other people who, you know, who truly were criminals or against or Confederates or whatever. And so she cleaned that up very quickly and won the accolades of her of the general in charge. And for that service, she got the Medal of Honor awarded to her by President Andrew Johnson. And she wore that medal every day of her life, the rest of her life. But as a sort of emancipated woman, she would travel from city to city. She went to London, England, for example, in 1866, and was absolutely ridiculed and was often thrown in jail because she wore pants. Hmm. And that was just not done. And so she would be accused of all sorts of things beyond just her attire. And so she really had a difficult time, but she seemed to enjoy herself in that role. She was, you know, you might call her a spitfire, or, you know, she enjoyed being the center of attention and really drawing attention to herself. When things would die down, she would bring them up again. She would show up at national political conventions and demand to be heard or give speeches and things. And so she really wanted to further the cause of equality, and did.
Very progressive for the time, though.
Oh, absolutely. Just almost by herself at the time.
Way ahead of her time. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about another woman that made a big impact on the Civil War, but definitely a more tragic figure. You talk about Mary Todd Lincoln.
Yes.
in this book. And as many of us know the history, wife of Abraham Lincoln, who ended up in a mental institution.
She did. And you can really understand when you just go through her life. She started out in the elite in Lexington. She was going to Mrs. Mentel's French school in Lexington. Her childhood playmate was John Cabell Breckinridge. When she went to Illinois and met and married Abraham Lincoln, she was sort of hitched her wagon to a rising star, and that was her goal. That's what she said. She said, "The man I marry will be president," and so she was sort of the power behind the politician. And when they got to the White House and the war broke out, she found, like many other Kentuckians, that the question split her family, and so she had several brothers on both sides. And that was tragic. No matter who died in a battle related to her, she mourned them. And because of that, a Confederate major or whatever who dies in battle, she's upset. And so people going through the White House would see that and accuse her of being a Confederate spy, for example. Lincoln had to go before a Senate committee and declare on a Bible, "My wife is not a Confederate spy." He had to do those things just because it split her family. She lost two sons during the war of sickness, and then she's sitting next to her husband when he's assassinated, and she couldn't deal with that. She, when President Lyndon Johnson took over for the assassinated President Kennedy, I believe Mrs. Kennedy left the White House in 2 weeks. I think it's something along the lines of 25 weeks. She could not get herself up. She couldn't get herself organized to the point where she could leave the White House. So the new president is over in the Treasury Department in some office operating the government that way, just trying to give her time.
Right.
And finally, she was able to leave. But a couple of years later, her son, Robert Todd Lincoln, had her committed to an insane asylum. Mm. And she just couldn't deal with, you know, what had happened to her. She eventually got out. She lived with her sister in Illinois. And she was instrumental in Abraham Lincoln's being buried in Springfield, Illinois. Otherwise, he certainly would have been in the Capitol because there was space for him as well as Washington there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, you also talk about in this book Cassius Clay, who was another progressive at the time.
Oh, absolutely. It's almost like a story out of the Bible. You see somebody who you expect to do one thing and they do the opposite. So Cassius Clay was the son of the richest, or the principal landholder in Kentucky. His name was Green Clay. He owned more slaves than anybody else in Kentucky at the time. And yet his son becomes anti-slavery, going to Yale College. He listened to a speech by William Lloyd Garrison, a noted abolitionist. And it was one thing to be in Connecticut or New England as an abolitionist, because lots of people agreed with you. But Clay went back to Kentucky and confronted what was called the slaveocracy, the people that ran the state. And he had to give speeches with a bowie knife and a pistol on a table in front of him in order just to have free speech, in order to work against slavery as the war began. And an unbelievable story. In the several weeks between the time that the war began and things could get organized, Lincoln was without protection. There was nobody guarding the White House. And Clay took it upon himself to organize a company of men that the federal government armed, and he camped out around the White House to defend it against Confederate attack. Mm. And Lincoln gave him, you know, some things for that. He became a major general in the Union Army in addition to what today would be an ambassador. Clay also moved Lincoln toward the Emancipation Proclamation. He was not going to give in. He was not going to allow the Civil War to be fought and emancipation not take place. And so politically, Lincoln was always riding the fence between, do I alienate Kentucky? Remember, he said to lose Kentucky is to lose the game. I can't say we're going to get rid of slavery early in the war, or I'm going to lose Kentucky and Maryland and Missouri. I can't do that. I can't release that information. But Clay sort of forced his hand, and that led to the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. So tell us quickly, but we just have a couple seconds left on the show, where can we find the book if we want to pick up a copy, Civil War Game Changers, Kentucky and Kentuckians in America's Bloodiest Conflict?
Well, you can primarily find it on Amazon, and it's also on Kindle. We're working with bookstores across Kentucky, so ask for it at the Coffee Tree. It's going to be everywhere, and we're working on that, but primarily Amazon and Kindle.
Okay, great. Well, we hope that our listeners will pick it up. Thank you again for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to come in.
Thank you, Leanne. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for tuning in to Open Mic. Our show is produced by Greg Jenkins, and our theme music is Turtle in the Creek, composed by Galen Green and performed by The Wooks. Produced by Moorhead State Public Radio with the generous support of listeners just like you. We'll see you next Friday.